The student works of great composers often revealed the greatness that was to come later in their lives. This is Student Composer of the Month, where we talk about anything and everything with composers who study or have recently studied in the greater Baltimore area, here on WBJC.com. Our first Student Composer of the Month is Nicholas Bentz, who currently studies at Peabody Conservatory and is in the process of looking for grad schools right now, if I am not mistaken.
That is correct, yes.
Where are you looking?
Well, right now I'm looking at a University of Southern California, San Francisco Conservatory, University of Michigan, and also Peabody as well.
Cool. And you currently study at Peabody with...
Well, I studied for the past 4 years with Kevin Putz, and right now I'm studying with Felipe Lara over at the conservatory.
And do you have any composers you were looking to study with at the other places? I would imagine you have.
Yeah, definitely. There are so many great composers out there right now to study with. Definitely foremost, for me at least, that I found would be Andrew Norman at USC. He's a fantastic composer. Came in second, actually, to Kevin Putz on the Pulitzer in 2012. But... almost 10 years as his junior, so I mean, excellent composer.
Right.
And he won the Grawemeyer Prize last year, I think, with his work Play. There's also Mason Bates at San Francisco, who's an amazing composer. He's one of the most performed composers in the country right now. Mm-hmm. And then Michael Dougherty's kind of the old war horse, I guess you could say, of the group.
Of who you're looking at to study
with? Yeah, of who I'm looking to study with, yeah. He's an excellent composer over at University of Michigan as well, so...
And then at Peabody, would you continue with Kevin Putz or Felipe Lara?
I was thinking of actually studying with Michael Hirsch.
Oh, okay.
That would actually be a really interesting avenue to explore.
Mm-hmm. And it's obviously a good thing to study with multiple different composers to get different composers' points of view.
Definitely. That's something that, I came to music as a performer first. I came as a violinist first. And so that was actually something that was kind of eye-opening to me is that, you know, when you're a performer, you're always taught, like, stick with your technique, stick with your teacher and your school of thought. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you're a composer, you're taught to just, like, broadcast to everyone, you know?
Yeah.
You want to get as many different viewpoints as you can.
Yeah, generally as performers, if something's working, we stick with the same teacher. But you want to evolve into something different or you feel like you can go in a different direction and you generally only change teachers when you don't feel like... you're going in either the right direction or that you can go any further with one in a certain direction. So talking about your teachers, you had studied with Kevin Putz for the majority of your time at Peabody.
Right, yeah.
And a bit of the time with Felipe Lara.
Yeah.
Am I pronouncing his name right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. So obviously, Kevin Putz, very distinguished composer himself, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Music for Silent Night, which is regularly performed now, as I'm aware of. They're doing it at Glimmerglass this year. Mm-hmm. Is it in the Mets season?
Not yet.
It's in somebody's season next year. I think it's in Minnesota Opera.
Yeah, it's in Minnesota. It's also getting an English premiere, I think, next year as well. So
right. So how would you say that your work is influenced by any teacher you've worked with's work and perhaps with Kevin Putz's work since you've worked with him the most?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that Kevin's work has had like a profound impact on me as a composer. Because when I started composition, my first teacher was very, very rigorous, very avant-garde. Mm-hmm. And that was obviously what I needed at the time. He really... taught me to think about music very differently, taught me how to like really think about form and structure in very unique ways. And then Kevin kind of came along and sort of told me to, you know, think with my heart a little bit more, kind of getting the left brain and the right brain to work at the same time, you know. Mm-hmm. Like I almost feel like my first teacher, Yorgos Vasilandinakis, and then Kevin Putz, they kind of each were kind of like on different shoulders, almost kind of talking to me in a way, which was a really great thing to have.
So your previous teacher, who was that?
His name was Yorgos Vasilandinakis.
All right.
It's a mouthful.
I generally, you know, pride myself on my pronunciation abilities, but that's a tough one.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that he worked with you to really expand how you think about composing music. So
yeah.
I imagine that would have... What would you have thought of previously, or what did you think of previously before you started working with him?
Yeah, I would say that You know, that's kind of the perspective that all, I kind of came in with the perspective that all student composers kind of come in with, which is like, I only want to write music this way, and it's going to be that way forever, you know? Like, I'm just going to write what I want to write, and that's going to be it. There's going to be no evolution whatsoever. But then, you know, like, you always have to have that person come and kind of lift the veil in a way. And he was kind of the person, he was definitely the person that did that for me.
Right.
Kind of showing me, like, all these different things that I can do with music, like, just like all these different avenues I can explore as a composer.
Right.
You know, Dr. Vassilis Ndonakis is really kind of an overqualified composer, I think, for his position. And as...
What is his position?
He's a professor at the College of Charleston. With his help and all the work that he's put in, it's really starting to become like a really very nice burgeoning like musical community down there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what I was raised in. And it's really fantastic. And, you know, coming into that environment as a student composer was really fortunate because, I mean, Dr. V is what we call him because very, very long name. Dr. V just had like, he always has had this very almost, I almost imagined like a guru kind of approach to composition. Like he always taught me that like composition is the utmost, it's like the most serious thing you can do like as an artist. And that, you know, like when you're writing music, you're taking yourself and you're just like throwing yourself onto the page, and like it's the most like it's a painful act for him to like compose,
right?
And so like he was like always translating like that seriousness, that sort of I can't think of a better word than seriousness for it, towards like the act of composing. And that was something that really has stuck with me. Like it's really built my foundation as a composer and really has spoken to like where I am now, I feel.
So would you say that seriousness that he instilled in you as a composer, would that be in your composition technique or your dedication to writing a certain amount each at interval, pick an interval, day, week, hour?
I would say it goes most towards my philosophy as a composer and kind of the way that I try to think about music and the way that I think about like kind of the progression of music and like what is good music in a way.
So since we're talking about you as a composer, what would that be in maybe in the short version? Or you can talk about the long version of your composition philosophy if you'd
My
like.
My compositional philosophy? That would be a very long conversation. But yes. I would say, you know, it's just a matter of taking your own personal expression and kind of distilling it down to its like most pure essence, and then kind of just like once you're able to find that your own individuality within that, then you need to find a way to project it onto the page.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the hard part. And then from there, you just need to find some kind of really great structure to latch onto as a composer, because you need some sort of structure to your music, yeah. I feel. And so like...
If it meanders too far, then it winds up just going nowhere.
Yeah, you always need to have a sense of unity as a composer. I feel like when I hear a piece that's disunified... unless there's some sort of philosophical underbearing to it, then I feel lost inside of it, which is sometimes that's not a bad thing.
Uh-huh.
There are certainly pieces that are good at being disorienting,
right,
and that I can definitely appreciate for being disorienting and being very disunified.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like a lot of Andrew Norman's pieces can come off like that. But then the beautiful thing about that is that you start to scratch under the surface and you see all these connections. You see like, oh, this relates to this and this relates to this. And there's so many... there's just like these like strata of like musical consequences, like operating on such a high level.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a beautiful thing to me. And that's also been a profound impact on me as I've studied the music of Andrew Norman.
Right. So we'll get to this piece later, but you mention in the liner notes of the new Symphony No. 1 CD, who you've done a lot of work with, and we'll talk about that in a second, that the piece, which serves as kind of the title track for it, Approaching Eternity, it's a semi-autobiographical piece, and I feel like that ties into your philosophy as a composer, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there are certain things that I've heard as a composer that have always stuck with me, and I'm sure that's same for every artist, you know, like we have these like adages that were passed on to us that just like remain with us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggest things was actually told to me by this composer that I only had a few lessons with, named Sean Shepard. He's a very, very skilled composer.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he said, you know, only you can write the music that you can write. So you should never be afraid of like, oh, because like when like the biggest thing today is like, oh, it's like taboo to write beautiful music, you know?
Right.
Like coming out of the serialist kind of monopoly on artistic expression that was the 20th century.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, it feels like that composition is taking a turn back into composing music that, first of all, audiences will immediately recognize as music, and second of all, is acknowledging the fact that there is an audience outside of their peers.
Mm-hmm.
And so you mentioned that it's sort of taboo to write beautiful music at this point still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's still like a sort of backlash against it, which is very, I mean, it's curious to me, but of course I don't have like the frame of reference that like a composer in the academy now at the age of like 60 or 70 would have, having been brought up in like this sort of single school style that was serialism in the American academy.
Because you've still got people who are, you know, 60 or 70 who are teaching, who were educated in that style. So they would pass it on in that way. And would you say that sometimes those teachers might neglect the fact that music is sort of taking a turn back towards an audience?
I would say that the bad ones do, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense to me.
I feel like a big thing that any composer should take into account is like an openness of style. Like that's something that's been really beautiful about like the teaching environment at Peabody, especially, is that all the composers, no matter how disparate their styles, like Michael Hirsch's music is so different from Kevin Putz's music. It's so different from Du Yun's music. It's so different from Oscar's music, and so different from Felipe's music.
Right.
But they're all like so cognizant as to how like beautiful like every single style can be.
Right.
Like there's a beauty in, you know, even the most jarring of sounds, like in Michael Hirsch's like extremely like discordant harmonies, there's like a very raw beauty to it.
So instead of composing music that is against being beautiful, they compose music to expand the definition of beautiful.
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah. I like that philosophy myself. I've actually sung a work, an early work, I think it was a student work of Michael Hirsch's.
Oh, nice.
I think I'm pretty sure he composed it when he was at Peabody as a student. Was he a student there?
Yeah, he was, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought, because it was from 1997, I believe. It's called From Ecclesiastes.
Oh, interesting.
It's a choral piece, obviously, as I'm a singer. And it actually kind of reminded me of, not to say that the piece was derivative at all, because I know that, you know, composers try to avoid their works being derivative as well. But it did remind me of a work that I had sung by Renee Clausen. A similar kind of, I would say, timbral structure in the voices. You know, it's, I don't know enough about Michael's music or about Renee Clausen's music or about, you know, choral compositions in the 90s in general to really say whether or not it is, you know, it is close or far away from what everybody else was doing at the time, but it did have, and I saw it as a good thing that it was, this, you know, it used these sort of, I don't know, it went between very open to very more crunchy harmonies. That's a very educated term I just used. that would make the music work in the way that it did.
Right.
So, talking about your pieces now.
Sure. Yeah.
We have three to listen to, and the first one we wanted to listen to was In the Harshest of Winters, right?
Yes. Yeah.
We'll listen to this, and then we'll get back. What would you like to say about the piece first?
Yeah. So this piece came about from a project concerning me and a very, very talented mezzo-soprano at Peabody currently named Mary Burke. And we've been friends for since our Peabody days. And so we came up with the idea to collaborate on a piece together. And I was, you know, just like searching for text, and I came across this very interesting text called In the Harshest of, or it's called To Pripyat, that's what it's called. And it's by this Ukrainian writer named Lyubov Sirota. And she actually lived in the city of Pripyat, which is in the exclusion zone of the Chernobyl, outside of the Chernobyl like explosion area.
Mm-hmm.
So when she was growing up, she lived only, I think, 5 miles away from the Chernobyl plant. And when I think she was in her 20s or so, when the explosion occurred and she was forcibly evacuated from the city, never to see it again. And she, you know, that's a huge impact on anyone, let alone a poet. And so she wrote this very, like, very stark, very depressing sort of warning to, like, to the world in a way, to, like, be more cognizant to, like, the way we use resources in a way, I guess you could say.
So the harshest of winters, would that refer to, like, a nuclear winter?
I guess it might. It might. I don't know what exactly she meant by that. I don't know if it means a nuclear winter or if it is more linked to the fact. I don't remember if the explosion itself happened in winter.
Uh-huh.
But I think that's a really interesting parallel, actually. And I wouldn't be surprised if she was thinking of that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I approached her to ask her if I could set this, and she was so grateful. And that's, you know, that's the best response you can get as a composer when you ask to use someone's work.
Yeah.
And so it was a really, really wonderful and very eye-opening experience to really work with this just profound text.
Yeah.
So
the piece is for voice and piano?
Yes, for a mezzo and piano.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the mezzo is Mary Burke, and the pianist?
Allison Tsai.
Allison Tsai. Great. Two people who are friends of mine and I have worked with. Wonderful. So this is this is the whole thing?
Yep, entire thing, yeah.
All right, so this is In the Harshest of Winters, performed by mezzo-soprano Mary Burke and pianist Allison Tsai.
Thank you.